Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. Thousands of refugees reach their hoped-for destinations, but many more are said to be on the way. Thousands of exhausted, elated people fleeing their Arab and Asian homelands reached their dream destinations of Germany and Austria Saturday, completing epic journeys by boat, bus, train, and foot to escape war and poverty. Before dawn, they clambered off a fleet of Hungarian buses at the Austrian border to find a warm welcome from charity workers offering beds and hot tea. Within a few more hours of rapid-fire aid, many found themselves whisked by train to the Austrian capital of Vienna and the southern German city of Munich. Austria and Germany made the breakthrough possible by announcing they would take responsibility for the mass of humanity that was already on the move west or camped out in their thousands at Keleti, the Budapest train station. Hungary on Tuesday had suspended train services from that station to Austria and Germany, compounding the buildup there as it sought to compel the visitors to register for asylum in Hungary. VOA's Luis Ramirez says many more refugees are most likely on the way.
I've been in touch with aid workers who say they are expecting, and they have reports of hundreds more getting through the Serbia's border with Hungary, getting through holes in the fence. Hungarian officials also reporting that the illegal crossings continue and that hundreds more are making their way either along highways or walking along railroad tracks on their way to Budapest. So the situation is not over for sure.
Keep up with the story by checking in to voanews.com. This is VOA News. The UN Children's Fund reports authorities in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia are being overwhelmed by the heavy influx of refugees, mainly from Syria, transiting to European countries for asylum. UNICEF describes chaotic scenes on the Macedonian side of the border with Greece as authorities vainly try to control huge crowds of refugees wanting to enter the country. Speaking on the phone from the capital, Skopje, UNICEF representative Bertrand Desmoulins said there has been a dramatic increase in the number of people arriving in recent days. He says the arrivals, which have been averaging around 3,500 a day, jumped to more than 5,600 on Thursday. Anti-Syrian government violence spread Saturday in the heartland of the country's Druze minority, a day after the assassination of a prominent anti-government cleric and explosions that also killed at least 25 others, according to activist and pro-government media. Supporters of Sheikh Wahid Baluz, who was the leader of a powerful Druze militia, blamed the government for the twin car bombings that killed him in southwestern Sweta province, an area that had largely stayed on the sidelines of the country's civil war. That according to the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Syrian TV footage showed mayhem in the aftermath of the explosion, with civilians scrambling to remove the injured from the scene as a huge cloud of black smoke billowed above. A death followed news of Baluz's assassination when angry local residents, some of them armed, attacked two security branches in Sweta. The cleric was a prominent critic of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, calling on youth in the Druze stronghold of Sweta province to refuse to serve in the military. Pakistan and Afghanistan held high-level talks Friday in Kabul. No official details were released of the one-on-one interaction between Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and Pakistan's National Security Advisor Sartaj Aziz. The meeting on the sidelines of the 6th Regional Economic Cooperation Conference on Afghanistan took place amid Kabul's complaints that Islamabad has failed to take action against Taliban and insurgents linked to the Haqqani network and allegedly operating from the Pakistani side of the border. Campaigning is concluded for Sunday's presidential elections in Guatemala, that despite calls for postponement and Thursday's resignation of President Otto Perez Molina over corruption allegations. Hundreds of protesters angry about the corruption scandal called for the election to be put off as they gathered at the Supreme Court building in Guatemala City, where Perez Molina appeared in court Thursday and Friday. I'm Ira Melman reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
What we are seeing now is phenomenal. We are seeing the kind of enthusiasm that we've never seen in the entire history of our multi-party politics over the past 20 years.
Supporters of the Tanzanian opposition Chadema Party show enthusiasm ahead of the upcoming general election.
Actually, the number of dead people involved in that accident is 13.
The government of Swaziland rejects what it calls propaganda tied to the recent road accident that killed virgin girls on their way to the annual reed dance ceremony.
Une jeune dame qui portait donc la bombe l'a détonée au marché du mille et des arrachés.
He says the first bomb was detonated by a young girl in the section of the market.
And Cameroon evacuates about 200 wounded people after recent suicide bomb attacks blamed on Boko Haram. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Prominent member of Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, says the intense enthusiasm exhibited by supporters is a significant boost to the opposition's effort. This, he says, is aimed to defeat the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi, or CCM party, in the October 25th general election. Parliamentarian Tundu Lissu told me that prospective voters won't change, adding that Tanzanians are displeased with the direction of the country, which he says will enable the opposition alliance known as UKAWA to defeat the CCM.
I have never seen anything like this since the first multi-party election in Tanzania 20 years ago. In 1995, we had huge crowds. In 2000, 2005, the crowds were a bit smaller. In 2010, we had huge crowds. What we are seeing now is phenomenal. We are seeing the kind of enthusiasm that we've never seen in the entire history of our multi-party politics over the past 20 years.
What does this say about the prospect of Chadema winning the presidential election, looking at the fact that the CCM, the ruling party, has won every election since independence?
Now, I'll say this. This year is going to be very different from all previous elections. Why? For the first time in our history as a multi-party state, the opposition coalition, UKAWA, and principally Chadema, did something that we have never done before. And that is we organized a massive voter registration drive all across the country. CCM was completely asleep. All other parties went to bed. We did register millions of Tanzanians almost entirely on our own. So the kind of crowds that we are seeing, we registered about 24 million registered voters. I will say perhaps 75% of those 24 million were registered because they had the Chadema message that they should register. So we are not only seeing huge crowds, we are also seeing massive crowds of registered voters. And registered voters who got registered because of Chadema. And this tells us that this election season is going to be very different from all previous elections.
I spoke with some Tanzanians, and they have said that the CCM knows how to win elections, and therefore they say that what the Chadema is doing right now, although credible, it's unlikely to defeat the CCM in the presidential election. What is your reaction to that?
Well, the CCM has been a master at rigging elections for sure. I'll say this, and not many people are going to like me for saying it. We have given them a free rein during previous elections. We've basically given them the room to rig elections. This year is different. We are more organized. We have party structures all across the country. We have a presence everywhere. And the surest way of preventing vote theft is to win so overwhelmingly that they are simply not going to be able to steal everything. So we have the kind of presence in the country that we've never had before. We have the kind of power and popular support that we've never seen in this country before. And we have learned a thing or two since 1995. This year is going to be different. We're not going to take any vote rigging lying down. That's for sure.
One of your leading members, Dr. Sla, who has championed Chadema's cause, has decided to leave the party, throwing pot shot at your presidential candidate, former Prime Minister Lowassa, saying he's corrupt, among other things. Will this undermine your effort to defeat the CCM in the election?
I don't think it will, really. I don't think it will have any significant impact. There is no doubt, and I'm saying this in all honesty, there is no doubt that Dr. Sla has played a massive role in the growth of Chadema in particular, but also he has played a huge role in the development of opposition politics in Tanzania over a span of more than 20 years of service. He has had a massive, massive influence. But this time around, when the opposition is poised to win the first contest, a contest since 1995, when we have a real chance to topple CCM, Dr. Sla has been away without leave. He's gone AWOL. You know, he's chickened out. And what he said yesterday, I think all Tanzanians will see it for what it is, a smoke screen, a campaign to get CCM to win this election. I think the kind of reaction that we have had since yesterday tells us that Dr. Sla's departure is not going to have any significant impact. His the respect he commands notwithstanding.
Tundu Lissu is a prominent member of Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Spokesman for Swaziland's government says opponents of the administration are using an accident last week that left several young women dead to tarnish the reputation of the Southern African Kingdom. Percy Simelane told me that those who are using the girls' death as a propaganda tool against the kingdom will not succeed in their plan to undermine the country's strong cultural heritage and political stability.
Actually, the number of dead people involved in that accident is 13. And then the international media reported that it was 68. Mathematically, it doesn't appear to be reasonable because we only had 8 admitted and then 3 were released after 2 days. We remained with 5 because the argument is that they know they were taking dead people, but then those who were taken to hospital died later on. Even Peter, even with the senses of a dead fly, you cannot get 55 deaths from 5 patients. It's impossible.
Is it the stance of the government that the accident is being used to tarnish the reputation of Swaziland? Is that the government stance?
Yeah, that's what we believe is happening. Somebody is taking advantage of this unfortunate accident to push his own personal agenda because the international media is quoting somebody outside Swaziland who happens to be somebody who has always told the people that he ran away from Swaziland for political reasons. So instead of running or heading a political office in South Africa, we believe he is heading a propaganda cell.
A group in Swaziland asked for the reef dance to be postponed in remembrance of the maidens that died. But the government appeared to say that the maidens died in serve of the king and the country. Why wasn't it postponed?
The reed dance is in the bracket of those customs of this country that cannot be stopped once started. One of them would be a wedding. Once a wedding has started, the process has started in Swaziland, you cannot stop it. Even if somebody in one of the families involved died, it also happened to the grandfather of the present king. That was King Bunu. He died during the most sacred of all traditions in this country. That is Incwala ceremony. He died during the Incwala ceremony, and the Incwala ceremony continued without him, despite the fact that it is always danced around the king. When there is no king, there is no Incwala.
So let me ask you this. Critics said that the maidens were being transported like cattle because they were at the open side of a truck, and that if these maidens were being transported in buses, their lives could have been spared or saved in this directive. What do you say to that?
Peter, only a few days ago, there was an accident in the Eastern Cape, that is South Africa, which killed more than 40 people. They were in a bus. The accident did not happen simply because these girls were traveling in trucks. Even if we were ferrying them using a Boeing 747 from where the reed is cut to the place where they dance, anything could have happened. We are, as a world and as a people, still missing the Malaysian airliner. They were flying. They're not using trucks in the air.
So what do you say to the critics of the king who say that he is picking too many women as wives? It's over 14 women now. He needs to stop because his budget keeps increasing and the wages of Swazi public sector workers have stagnated and all that. What do you say to such critics?
More than we are not aware that the king has now more than 14 wives. We are not aware. I wonder where the other one comes from. What's called the statement was factual. Now, it is difficult to defend something that is actually not even factual. The statistics are not factual. Maybe I can only say that in our tradition, the king can take as many wives as he can. Even if this particular king did not want to have more than just one wife, the tradition of the Swazi people would not have allowed that to happen.
Percy Simelane is the spokesman for the Swaziland government. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. Cameroon says it has evacuated at least 200 wounded people after twin suicide bomb attacks in Kerawa on its northern border with Nigeria's Borno state left at least 20 people dead. The attack has been blamed on the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Cameroon's government spokesman and communication minister, Issa Chiroma Bakari, says the wounded have been moved to hospitals in neighboring towns as the lone hospital in Kerawa is not large enough. Issa Chiruma says the attacks at the Kerawa market were carried out by Boko Haram fighters.
Une jeune dame qui portait donc la bombe l'a détonée au marché du mil et des arachides.
He says the first bomb was detonated by a young girl in the section of the market where women sell millet and groundnuts, and the second was detonated by a man near the military base where people had taken those wounded in the first explosion for treatment. Issa Chiruma says about 20 of the victims are in critical condition. In July, about 60 Cameroonians were killed along the Central African nation's northern border with Nigeria's Borno state, stronghold of Boko Haram. The insurgents used teenage female suicide bombers in four attacks. Cameroon, in response, sent back about 5,000 Nigerians who claimed to be fleeing the Boko Haram insurgency but refused to go to refugee camps. Boko Haram, which was founded in northern Nigeria, attacks Cameroon regularly for supporting the Nigerian military's mission to crush the group. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Meanwhile, despite losing control of territory as the Nigerian army continues to recapture towns along the Cameroonian border, Boko Haram maintains a large fighting force. Kabir Matu is a political science professor at the University of Abuja. Reporter Douglas Mpuga reached him there to find out how the militants have managed to survive all this long.
One of the areas where Nigerian government got strong initially was the inability to immediately bring together multinational force like they had to do much later, because the areas of operation of the insurgency is mainly around the fringes of border areas between Nigeria, Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, Nigeria, Niger Republic, and so on and so forth. So it's really very difficult, given the so-called sovereignty and the national boundaries of the countries, for Nigeria to perhaps be able to chase or pursue insurgents into any of these countries without a concrete military agreement on the ground. And I think the government of Goodluck Jonathan that was removed in May this year only came to think about the necessities of, having this multinational force when, the crisis really became too significant, too unbearable, and also facing the crisis of election and so on and so forth. But above all, I think the multinational joint task force now also realizes the very serious nature of the political leadership on ground, because the government of General Muhammadu Buhari, since coming to power, has released quite a tremendous quantum of resources that will help, boost the morale of the troops on one hand, and on the other hand also get all available logistics and possibly weaponry and other, to be able to contend with this crisis.
Dr. Matt, there were issues of morale among the Nigerian forces, accusations of corruption, even accusations of some elements in the Nigerian forces maybe collaborating with the militants. Has the morale changed? Has the discipline improved?
I think that's a very important, factor that has, resulted in allowing the insurgency to degenerate to the level that, it has reached. So things have changed now. The morale of the soldiers is gradually boosting, because the mere sighting of credible leadership on the part of President Muhammadu Buhari sends a lot of signals. It is not about commanders now going to Borno, Yole, Biola, or Yobe State to simply run a fanfare and then come back to Abuja. The battle is being re-strategized. The soldiers, have the spirit of fighting. Their morale is high, and the commanders are determined, because the president has specifically instructed them to end the insurgency within 3 months. So I think two things now. One is that certainly the morale of the soldiers and their spirit to fight this battle is, all-time high, specifically because of the seriousness they see on the part of the commander-in-chief. And secondly, also the adjustment by way of appointment of new security chiefs in the country that took place just recently also indicated the fact that little politics was involved in the selection exercise, but rather the rigorous military capabilities of individual service chiefs, was what was taken into consideration. So it's going to be very difficult to automatically just wake up in the morning and automatically see that all these issues are dealt with or are addressed. The insurgency deploys the guerrilla tactics in the discharge of its own kind of warfare. And therefore, it is not surprising that you will hear one bomb in this part today, you will hear the other one, because they will have to continue to do it like that. But the important thing that I think is happening now is that their central nervous system is gradually being decapitated by the Nigerian military, as well as by the joint task force that has been put in order to address this problem.
Kabir Mato is a political science professor at the University of Abuja. He spoke with reporter Douglas Mpuga from the Nigerian capital. The UN World Food Programme says it will be forced to shut down a life-saving air service in Sudan by the end of the month unless nearly $10 million in funding is found. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The WFP and other aid agencies rely upon the UN Humanitarian Air Service, or UNHAS, to get aid and personnel where they are needed. The service is especially crucial in Sudan, where vast distances, insecurity, and poor roads make it virtually impossible for aid workers to reach remote areas by car. But the air service may be grounded in Sudan unless the WFP can close a $9.9 million funding shortfall. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lusher tells VOA the service has become even more critical since Sudan's government began new military operations against rebel groups in December.
In the last few months, the situation has become more complicated. So more than 200,000 people have been displaced. And Sudan is a country with very little infrastructure. Many of the aid operations are in far-fetched places. If the UN Humanitarian Air Service cannot fly the aid workers into those regions, we cannot reach some 40 locations where the humanitarians are working.
In the first half of this year, UNHAS Sudan transported nearly 20,000 passengers and more than 110 metric tons of cargo. It also has carried out some 16 medical and security evacuations. Lusher warns these critical services will stop by the end of September if UNHAS is forced to shut down for lack of funds. She says humanitarian workers will have to resort to dangerous road travel to reach people in need, and many people will likely be deprived of food, water, health care, and other essential relief. WFP says the amount of money requested is a relative pittance when weighed against the assistance advised for millions of people in this crisis-ridden country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And in Zimbabwe, a magistrate has ordered Police Commissioner General Augustine Chihuri and Home Affairs Minister Ignatius Chombo to compensate an individual for wrongful arrest, pain, and suffering as a result. For VOA, Thomas Chiripasi has details from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Chiret's magistrate Tafadzwa Mhlanga today ordered the Police Commissioner General and the Home Affairs Minister to pay $550 in compensation to Zulu Jinya for wrongful arrest and pain suffered during his arrest last year. During the hearing of the matter, the court heard that Jinya was severely assaulted by cops while in police custody. One of Jinya's lawyers, Pegitava Gadza of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights, told Studio 7 over the phone from Chiredzi that the legal team welcomed the court's ruling.
A landmark ruling was given. The case went through the trial process and today a ruling was delivered wherein he was given judgment for assault and wrongful arrest.
The attorney said the magistrate was unequivocal in condemning the police practice of assaulting suspects during detention, saying it was unlawful for the police to physically punish suspects.
He stressed that no one was above the law and the rule of law is too operational in the country. The judgment he gave should be a deterrent to other would-be offenders.
Tavagadza said several Chingwizi villagers' cases of public violence are still before the court.
29 villagers were initially brought before the courts for public violence and were found not guilty, went before the civil courts claiming for damages for wrongful arrest and assault during arrest.
The Chingwizi villagers' lawyer told Studio 7 that several people continue to live in squalid conditions ahead of the rainy season, adding that they do not know what is awaiting them.
Their situation is really bad indeed, and it is inhuman and degrading. They are still in temporary shelters, which we cannot really call shelters, because the tents that were given to them by humanitarian organizations have now gone out, and they cannot even farm. The place is very dry and is not suitable for human habitation.
About 3,500 families were left without shelter and food after their homes were swept away by floods that occurred at Tokwe Mukosi Dam in Mashingo, while many children were left with no access to education. The government forcibly moved most of the flood victims to Nwanetsi Range, where they are said to be struggling to survive. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Baba Miloni, for killing somebody. They say love is blind, but I didn't see her for your eyes. Oh.
yes, you want a girl like Adi. You show my daddy. Listen, call me your daddy. Call me your daddy. Baby girl, let me take you round the body. Take you so far and wide. Call me your daddy. So baby girl, call me your daddy. I take you so far and wide. I take you to sunny side. Hello, my name is David O. Where are you from? I want to know.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, I look at African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. With this as my point of departure, I look at what is going on now with regard to U.S. policy and the implications for Africa. Right now, one of the major issues as a breakthrough for the Obama administration is the slow progress towards the finishing line on the nuclear discussion. We're still in this torn and of debate. And hopefully, by the end of the year, the people who are interested in peaceful diplomacy will see they came out of the tunnel and saw the light of enlightenment and cooler heads among humans. Hopefully, we'll see to it that the Iranians will honor their commitment to what they bargain with the U.S. and the other world countries that negotiated the dialogue. This is the big negotiation that is very much part of the Obama story. And of course, those who are talking about legacies, including this humble self on this media and elsewhere, who are talking about Obama legacy, will see the Iran issue as a big issue. So if you go back and look at the legacies identified in this media and elsewhere by other scholars or people who are blogging, you can see that from 2008 to where we are now, the Obama administration will be remembered by historians with Obamacare, to the point that his administration and all the people who are involved in various capacities with the administration will be talking about how Obamacare is very much part of the story. Let me just focus on two points that are related to issues now. The big question of immigration, stupid, which is now being debated by politicians around the planet, is a big issue. In the United States, the Obama administration is trying to deal with immigration, and of course, is a bone of contention in the new presidential debate among the candidates. Immigration is not an Obama issue or problem. It was inherited by President Obama from his predecessors. So when you look at immigration, it is a coin with two sides, tail and head. With regards to the head, immigration could be seen as an American problem in the United States, and the Mexicans and the Latinos are very much part of the local debate. But the other side of immigration, which has implications for the Obama administration and world leaders, particularly in Europe, is immigration of human beings, where the human beings who are caught in this phenomena could be dignified by the UN in the category of refugees. But the most humiliating and politically demeaning side of it, you can be a victim of violence, or you are fleeing from dictatorship, tyranny, or religious bigotry anywhere else in the world, and you find yourself not declared as a refugee with UN status and dignity, well, you may find yourself in the most painful situation of those people who are the victims of political collapse in what former Secretary of State Albright called failed states, as in Somalia. Today, the Obama administration is dealing with the head and tails of immigration policy at home and overseas. Right now, the Americans are looking closely on what is happening in Hungary and what is happening in Europe. And of course, American authorities who deal with migration are looking on. And of course, the Hungarian dilemma, which is really a very serious diplomacy. It has implications for America, for the Obama administration, and it has implications for Africa. Let me connect the dots so that we can conclude this narrative with regard to immigration and legacies of President Obama. Right now, the nuclear issue is going to be debated all over the world in various editorials. The Nobel Peace Prize winners are looking on President Jimmy Carter, who is now very much going through a crisis, must be thinking about what happened to him and what Sadat, Begin, and others in the Israeli-Arab relationships and what led to the Nobel Prizes. When we look at immigration, you can see how immigration is very much linked to diplomacy or lack of diplomacy. And the crisis of the Syrians is one of the serious problems facing the Obama administration, the Russians, the Iranians, the Saudis, and all those other people. And what is happening to the Syrian people is a good illustration of lack of negotiation among political leaders in the world and the consequences of their callousness against even their own people. That's the way it is today. How diplomacy can save us, but how human bigotry can ruin us. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a family is like a forest. When you are outside, it is dense. When you are inside, you see that each tree has its place. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the final days of August, the Nigerian-based terrorist group Boko Haram carried out a half dozen raids on villages in northeast Nigeria, reportedly killing more than 80 people. The United States strongly condemns these attacks. These raids are just another example of the horrific and indiscriminate violence that Boko Haram continues to use to terrorize civilians in northeastern Nigeria and the Lake Chad Basin region. Governor of Nigeria's Borno State, Kashim Shettima, confirmed the attacks. According to the Associated Press, he said, "I want us all to understand that the Boko Haram crisis is a calamity that has befallen us, as the insurgents do not discriminate whether somebody is Christian or Muslim. Neither do they have any tribal sympathy or affiliations." August 27th marked the 500th day since Boko Haram kidnapped 276 girls from their school in Chibok. The kidnapping galvanized international attention for the Boko Haram conflict. It is one of many attacks, kidnappings, raids, and other acts of indiscriminate violence that continue on a frequent basis in Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. According to press reports, Boko Haram has killed more than 15,000 people since 2009. Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, recently visited Washington, where he and President Barack Obama discussed ongoing plans to defeat the terrorist group Boko Haram. President Obama expressed his support for President Buhari's very clear agenda in defeating Boko Haram extremists of all sorts inside his country. The U.S. contributes to these efforts through a number of security and counterterrorism assistance programs, which provide intelligence, advisors, training, equipment, and logistics. The United States also provides support to the multinational joint task force, which the Lake Chad Basin countries and Benin are standing up to coordinate the regional efforts to counter Boko Haram. The United States will continue to support the governments and people of the Lake Chad Basin region in their struggle to defeat Boko Haram.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.